In 1979, Iranian students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. The Iranians held the American diplomats hostage for 444 days.
They put guns to your head and count from 10 to 1 and say, either answer or we'll shoot you.
The embassy takeover and its political aftermath led to 21 years of hostility, economic sanctions, and terrorist attacks. But now, many in the U.S. and Iran say time has healed the wounds. One of the former hostages says he's willing to return to Iran if it will promote peace.
Bring the hostages back to Iran to visit with Iranian leadership. If we could be there, anything could happen.
Stay tuned for The Struggle for Iran, a special one-hour public radio documentary. I'm your host, Walter Cronkite. More after this. 20 years ago, 52 U.S. Embassy hostages flew home from Iran after 444 days in captivity. Their ordeal forever marked recent American history. It helped doom the re-election of President Jimmy Carter in 1980. It set the basis for the Reagan administration's Iran-Contra scandal. To this day, the U.S. continues economic sanctions against Iran. Yet many people in the United States and Iran say enough time has passed to heal the wounds. At the end of the program, we'll explain how you can find out more by visiting our website, www.iranproject.org. I'm Walter Cronkite. Stay tuned for The Struggle for Iran, a one-hour special report from The Iran Project. The 1979 seizure of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran traumatized the American hostages and the American nation. But with the passage of time, at least some of the hostages and their captors have come to closure about the incident. Some now share a common hope for a democratic Iran. Most of the former students who seized the embassy are today fighting against Iranian conservatives and for democratic reform. Producer Reese Ehrlich gathered material for this story in New York and Tehran.
I spent most of my life in New York, New York City, and New York State.
Barry Rosen grew up in a middle-class Jewish family.
My first foreign experience in my entire life happened to be as a Peace Corps volunteer in Iran in 1967 to 69. So I was a Brooklyn boy, actually totally out of my element, landing up in Iran, and I really loved it. It was a place that I really felt that it was my second home, and in many ways I still do.
My father was studying in the University of Pennsylvania for his PhD in mechanical engineering.
Masumeh Eftekhar was born in Tehran, but spent part of her childhood in a suburb of Philadelphia.
I have memories of going to school there. I had very, very good friends in the school that I went there. Of course, as a child, elementary school.
Fast forward a few years. In 1979, Rosen is press officer at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. Eftekhar is enrolled as a first-year student at Tehran's Polytechnic Institute. They didn't know each other, not yet. For over 25 years, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi had run a brutal dictatorship in Iran, backed by the U.S. government. In early 1979, the Shah fled Iran in the face of a popular uprising of Muslims, nationalists, and leftists. They were united in a hatred of the Shah and of what they saw as U.S. domination of Iran. Some in the Shah's military fought to stay in power.
The most incredible thing is that after each fusillade of bullets, these people are returning to this square. You can hear the shooting right now. They've been telling us for weeks they're willing to put their lives on the line, and that's exactly what they're doing.
The popular uprising triumphed, and an Islamic government came to power. In October 1979, President Jimmy Carter allowed the Shah to enter the U.S. to receive medical treatment. Many Iranians believed the U.S. was planning to restore the Shah's rule. On November 4th, Muslim students stormed the U.S. Embassy in protest of Carter's actions. Masumeh Eftekhar became their press spokesperson. The Western media called her Tehran Mary.
The Marines, they were shocked to see, you know, a group of students coming in like this. And maybe initially they didn't think that these people were organized.
They had pictures of Khomeini pinned to their shirts and their sweaters, and they had clubs, and our guards seemed to disappear. They came directly to my office, which was very close to the gate. In a very foolish way, I said, look, this is American property, and you have to exit this place. You know, I figured, well, you know, what can I lose? I'm in deep trouble already. And the Iranian said, you know, told me to shut up in Farsi, and they held an automatic weapon against my head.
Initially, everybody thought that it wouldn't take more than a couple days, maybe a couple hours.
The students assumed that Iranian police would quickly remove them from the embassy. But Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the revolution's top leader, saw an opportunity to humble the U.S. government while garnering popular support at home. He backed the embassy takeover.
It started to rain harder and harder, and I felt this had a certain symbolism to it all. You know, my life was getting bleaker and bleaker, and I didn't know if I was going to live at all, or if I was marching toward an execution. We were tied hand and foot. They would take some of the cord from drapes and tie you up. I was forced to sleep bound hand and foot for several days. They were so frightened of us, they thought that we were all members of the CIA, and they had seen many motion pictures of James Bond over the years, so they were frightened, and they thought that we were Superman. There were moments when the Iranians did interrogate us, and there were moments when they would put guns to your head and count from 10 to 1 and say, either answer or we'll shoot you.
Rosen says after a few weeks, their physical conditions got better, but the hostages were to endure 444 days of mental anguish, sometimes held in dank cellars and prisons. Even today, however, Eptikhar doesn't apologize for that treatment.
It's a matter of collective rights, individual rights. It's very difficult to compare the sufferings that the Iranian nation felt during 50 years of foreign domination, and comparing that with the sufferings or the pain that they may have faced during these days.
Abbas Abdi, one of the main leaders of the embassy takeover, says the hostages' treatment flowed from the kind of violence that America taught Iran for nearly 30 years.
Some of them ask us, well, why did you occupy the embassy? Why did you take those people hostage? We say, well, we were raised by you. We were trained by you.
Ayatollah Khomeini and his conservative supporters used the hostage crisis to consolidate power. They established an authoritarian Islamic state that imprisoned, tortured, and killed opponents. In the 1980s, Iran also fought a bitter 8-year war with Iraq. It devastated Iran's economy. By the 1990s, Iranians were ready for change. The former captors became leading advocates of political reform. They wanted an Islamic government and continued to oppose U.S. domination of Iran, but they also opposed government corruption and the growing gap between rich and poor. Former student leader Abbas Abdi says his ideas about Iran's revolution matured.
At the time of the Shah, our picture, our image of a democratic system was not a very realistic one. Obviously, people who live in this under a despotic regime may aspire and wish for a democratic regime, but the image that they have of that regime may be a variation of the same despotic regime.
Abdi, Eptikhar, and other former student leaders strongly supported reformist Mohammad Khatami when he was elected president in 1997. Later that year, relishing the relative freedom of the new administration, Abdi flew to Paris to meet with Barry Rosen. The meeting was heavily covered in the Iranian media.
I didn't know if I could forgive. I don't forget what went on. I will never forget that. But as soon as we met each other, and that was over dinner, we started to talk, and it's as if everything melted away. We still had different points of view, but Abbas Abdi right now is a man who is fighting for some law and order in Iran to build a democratic system within the country.
In private meetings, Rosen and Abdi reconciled themselves on a personal level, but the rendezvous did nothing to warm up relations between the U.S. and Iranian governments. Today, Barry Rosen is an administrator at Columbia University's Teachers College. Masuma Eptikar is a vice president of Iran in charge of environmental affairs. Abbas Abdi heads a research institute in Tehran. In a sense, Rosen has exchanged roles with his two former captors. He no longer feels the pressure of being an embassy spokesperson. But Eptikar and Abdi face tremendous responsibilities as prominent political reformers in Iran. Today, says Rosen, people like Abdi are fighting the uphill battle.
I'm almost sure the regime is on his back all the time. I feel very close to the man in many ways because he's going through a lot of difficulty right now. And I remember when I said goodbye to him when he was going back to Tehran, I said, be careful. And I was worried about it.
Rosen says when the time is right, he'd like to return to Iran with the other former hostages to hold discussions with Iranian leaders. That, he says, would be the final closure for an incident that traumatized him and the two nations.
If we could be there, anything could happen.
For the Iran Project, I'm Reese Erlich.
American news coverage of Iran often focuses on conflicts with the U.S. or disputes among Iran's governing elite. But we hear less about the profound grassroots changes in Iran over the past 21 years. What do ordinary Iranians think of the Islamic Revolution? And how do those views impact government policy? Producer Reese Erlich begins the story in Amameh, a rural town northeast of Tehran.
Hassan Khavari gives a mighty shove and opens the door of his small oil change garage.
We put new oil and we change the filter and we do it in the old-fashioned way.
Khavari is a village elder. He holds no political office, but people go to him for advice and to informally settle disputes. Sitting in a bare office next to his garage, Khavari says the revolution has improved life for rural folks.
Before the revolution, all these boulevards and the streets that you see didn't exist. We didn't have electricity, we only had some small houses made out of clay, and right now that you see that we have this boulevard, and it's much nicer than many neighborhoods in Tehran.
Khavari says in the old days, the U.S. dominated Iran. Iranians resented American officials, military officers, and businessmen, in part because they enjoyed immunity from prosecution.
The Americans were controlling our lives. If an American citizen would commit a crime in Iran, he or she would be treated under the American law. And that's like slavery. They could do whatever they wanted.
The U.S. has maintained economic sanctions against Iran for over 21 years, something Khavari sees as a source of Iran's economic problems today. 17% unemployment and 30% inflation. But even more than those issues, he worries about the decline in Islamic morality. Khavari's brother Ahmed says the reforms have gone too far.
Islam tells us that people who are not related to a woman should not see one piece of her hair or one piece of skin. But now you do, and this is not acceptable under Islam.
While they support President Khatami on other matters, these two brothers in rural Iran would close the door on him if Iran strays too far from a strict interpretation of Muslim morality. Such conservative attitudes on social issues are widespread in Iran, and they set the parameters for Iranian politics, even for the reformers. Students here at the Organization for Fostering Unity, the country's main student organization, say reformers are hardly a united group. Some are nationalists, others are secular leftists, but the vast majority are firm believers in the Islamic Republic who want more democracy within the existing system. Student leader Ali Ashfari welcomes visitors into his office. It's certainly a grassroots operation. Foam rubber peeks out of slits in the chair cushions, and paint peels off the walls. Ashfari strongly supports close ties between mosque and state, but he objects to the existence of a new conservative elite.
When I entered the university, people in certain very conservative organizations got special treatment. So we formed local organizations to create equality.
In 1979, leaders of the Islamic Revolution promised to fight poverty and create an egalitarian society. Today, a new elite of businessmen and clerics control the country. Iranian reformers advocate democratic change, but that doesn't mean they want a U.S.-style system, says Ashfari.
For over 50 years, America has worked to weaken democracy in Iran. America must acknowledge our right to sovereignty and our interests. The U.S. must create trust, remove its military forces from the Persian Gulf, and end the sanctions against Iran.
Ashfari says many young people are losing patience with President Khatami, who was elected promising reforms, but frequently backs down in the face of conservative attacks. Ashfari, for example, criticizes the president for failing to help reopen dozens of reformist newspapers closed by conservative judges last year.
Many reformers don't have any way to publish their views. There hasn't been enough done to allow formation of new political parties. There's not enough freedom for organizations. But our main criticism is against the conservatives. They're making it hard for President Khatami to carry out reform.
Interestingly enough, Ashfari turns out to be a rather mild critic of Khatami compared to some other young people. On Friday mornings, thousands of young people hike for miles along dirt paths here in the Stone Park above Tehran. A group of 10 friends stop to listen to music from a boombox. A casual conversation quickly turns angry as Roya, age 23, denounces the status of women in Iran.
I would like to see more freedom, more equality. Girls can't play certain sports, and there are few sports facilities for girls. The militias still come after us. At a birthday party for my family, they took us away for wearing makeup and claimed we were a mixed group of unrelated boys and girls. They held us for 2 days.
While it doesn't happen frequently these days, government-sanctioned militias can still detain women with inadequate head coverings or groups of unrelated men and women congregating together. Roya was the victim of precisely the conservative policies advocated by auto garage owner Hassan Khavari. Iran is a deeply divided society. A large majority of Iranians voted for reform when they elected President Khatami in 1997 and put a majority of reformists into the parliament in 2000. But the president and parliament don't hold real power. Conservative clerics maintain control through the courts, right-wing vigilantes, police and military. And the conservatives certainly have a popular base of support. Mohammad Abtahi, first secretary to President Khatami, says some young people push too hard and give conservatives an excuse to crack down.
They elevate the demands of the society to the point that they're not, it's not possible to fulfill them, and it just leads to confrontations and conflict.
Abtahi says youthful militants don't appreciate the depth of conservative sentiment in Iran.
There are people inside who should limit their demands and expectations and balance their demands and expectations. So even if there are people who want this place to become like Switzerland, they should remember that apart from the belief issues, there is a culture here. And this culture is embedded in the people. And if a government comes into power, and it's not saying that it regards it, basically all it has to do is ignore or disregard this culture. And I can honestly say it would be an unsuccessful government. You should accept the fact that one of the main reasons for the downfall of the Shah was his neglecting of the religious issues of the people.
President Khatami, himself an Islamic clergyman, seems likely to continue with his go-slow policies. But pressure from below is constantly boiling up. Roya, interviewed in Stone Park, typifies the impatience of many young Iranians.
President Khatami has made a lot of promises, but hasn't come through. Maybe they haven't allowed him to make the reforms, but maybe he was just trying to get votes.
Because Iranian society itself is so deeply split, the battle between conservatives and reformers will likely continue for some time. When presidential elections take place this spring, Iranians will have another chance to express their views about the need for reform and how fast it should come. For the Iran Project, Amri Sirlik in Tehran.
I'm Walter Cronkite, and you're listening to The Struggle for Iran, a special documentary on public radio. Iran's neighbors face political and economic turmoil. As a result, Iran today hosts more refugees than any other country in the world and receives almost no international aid for them. Refugees from Iraq and Afghanistan are welcomed into Iranian communities, not held in refugee camps. But many Iranians now blame the refugees for the country's high unemployment and other economic problems. Correspondent Keith Porter visited Mashhad, an Iranian city 150 miles from the Afghan border.
These Afghan musicians living in Mashhad sing mournfully of their homeland. They fled Afghanistan when the Taliban regime seized power in 1996 and banned all music as un-Islamic. From 1979 to 1992, Iran accepted Afghan refugees both for humanitarian and political reasons. The government opposed the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and later came to oppose the Taliban, an Islamic regime that is too fundamentalist even for the Iranians. Iran criticizes the Taliban for oppressing women and holds Taliban responsible for the murder of 8 Iranian diplomats. But these days, Iran faces 17% unemployment and 30% inflation. Many Iranians blame the refugees for these economic hardships.
Yes, they take away their jobs from Iranians and they work for lower wages and they
This is Shohada Square, a loud and busy traffic circle in the middle of Mashhad. On one side of the street, Afghan day laborers stand, hoping to get low-paying construction jobs. Across the street, Iranians congregate, competing for the identical work.
The government should either throw them out of the country, or they have to do something about our situation. They have war in their country, we understand, but they come here and they take the jobs away from us.
During economic hard times, similar resentment is often voiced in the United States and other countries. Arguments favorable to the immigrants have a familiar ring as well. Amina Safi Afzali is a leader of the Afghan Islamic Women's Movement in Mashhad.
Afghan refugees are not taking away jobs. Afghans work the hardest and lowest paying jobs, which the Iranians won't do. Unemployment among Iranians is mostly among the educated people, and they won't do these jobs.
Scapegoating immigrants is partly the result of shifting political priorities inside Iran, according to Carol Faubert, head of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Iran.
The attitude has changed. During the early 80s, the struggle of the Afghans was looked upon as a jihad, and there was a lot of spontaneous sympathy. Solidarity was stressed. Now we're very much in a state of civil war. And a situation that is now entering its third decade. So, in a sense, there is what I would call asylum fatigue.
Mohammad Ali Abtahi, first secretary to Iran's president, Mohammad Hatami, expresses the new, wary attitude of the Iranian government.
The world can't expect us to host this many refugees without any help and without any aid. The fact is they have taken away a lot of jobs from Iranian workers. Unemployment is relatively high in the country. So it would be natural for us to want to repatriate some of these refugees back to their own countries.
About 2 million Afghans live in Iran today. In 1992, Iran stopped issuing identity documents to Afghan refugees. That means hundreds of thousands live illegally and are subject to deportation. Last year, the government of Iran and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees began a voluntary repatriation program that offers Afghan refugees a free trip back to Afghanistan and $20, the equivalent of several months' pay.
After the invasion of Afghanistan, I came to Iran, which is almost 20 years.
Hakim, along with his wife and four children, have accepted the offer to return home. Hakim and his sons have barely scraped by, working low-paying jobs. They're among hundreds of Afghan refugees at a repatriation center outside of Mashhad, preparing to board buses for an all-night journey.
We had a fair life in Iran. But since recently it's getting difficult to get work, and in the media we hear that they tell Afghans they should go back to their country. So we decided to go back before anything, you know, else happens.
The UN and the government of Iran try to ensure that these refugees are returning voluntarily and that genuine political refugees can apply for asylum. So far, officials say about 4,500 refugees return to Afghanistan every week. But officials can't say how many immediately come back to Iran.
I don't think the refugees can endure the difficulties in Afghanistan.
Afzali, from the Islamic Women's Association, believes the repatriation program will fail because Iran and the UN can't solve the underlying problem, political and economic turmoil inside Afghanistan.
I don't think this program will be successful. People are fleeing the Taliban rule. I don't think the Taliban have changed their attitude toward women. They have not changed their policies. As long as we have the original problem people are fleeing from, we can't solve the repatriation problem.
Back at the Afghan refugees' home, the musicians play a plaintive song about eternal wandering. Iranians have always been famous for their hospitality. Refugees were welcomed here on humanitarian grounds and as a way of spreading the Islamic Revolution. But now, Iranian hospitality is running out. For the Iran Project, I'm Keith Porter in Mashhad, northern Iran.
You're listening to The Struggle for Iran. Coming up, biases in U.S. media coverage of Iran and why Tehran is considered the Bermuda Triangle of U.S. foreign policy. Also, pop music and sexy dancers as weapons in a cultural battle between Los Angeles and Tehran. For more information about Iran or to post your comments about this program, visit our website at www.iranproject.org. That's www.iranproject.org. I'm Walter Cronkite. More after this. In Iran, conservative political forces have closed reformist newspapers, afraid that people might learn the truth about government corruption and repression. But having a more open press in the U.S. doesn't mean Americans get accurate reporting about Iran. In fact, critics say for many years, major U.S. media distorted events in Iran in furtherance of U.S. foreign policy goals. Correspondent Deepa Fernandez reports from New York.
The 1950s was a trying time for the U.S. media.
Last night I discussed the communists in the State Department I stated that I had the names of 57 card-carrying members of the Communist Party. When I have the names of 57, you can be right well sure there are a lot more.
Many major newspapers uncritically reported Senator Joseph McCarthy's sneers, and many reported foreign policy issues from a simplistic anti-communist perspective. In 1950, Mohammad Mossadegh became prime minister in Iran. He was a nationalist who favored greater democracy and initially enjoyed U.S. support. But in 1953, he nationalized Western oil holdings in order to give Iranians a greater share of the country's oil wealth. That outraged the oil companies and the U.S. government. Professor Mansour Farhang, who now lives in New York, is a former Iranian ambassador to the UN and has written a book analyzing U.S. media coverage of Iran.
The press depicted it as very radical, that Iranians were not capable of doing this. It was going to disturb the international oil market. It was something unusual, which it was.
Prime Minister Mossadegh allowed political parties and newspapers of all political stripes to function openly. But Professor Farhang says both the U.S. government and media vilified the Prime Minister because he wouldn't side with the U.S. against the USSR.
They didn't believe in neutrality. They didn't believe in authentic democratic development within a country, but that was not an ally of the West or the East. These articles portray Mossadegh as either a communist, which was absolutely outrageous, or someone who really didn't have a coherent view of what he wanted.
U.S. government documents now confirm that in 1953, the CIA masterminded a coup against Prime Minister Mossadegh. The U.S. installed the pro-Western Shah Reza Pahlavi.
In the quick shift of power, Mossadegh was finally apprehended and awaits trial for treason. The Shah, who had fled to Rome, comes home, backed by General Zahedi, military strongman, who engineered his return to power. Iranian oil may again flow westward.
From 1953, after the coup, to 1979, the image of Iran in the U.S. media is a country going through the process of modernization.
Professor Mansour Farhang.
He is pursuing modernization and reform from the top. A modernizing monarch who was, as Henry Kissinger said, an unconditional ally.
The Shah's well-rounded personality is felt throughout Iran. Like his father, the present Shah has always had one thing uppermost in mind, to improve the lot of his people.
Norman Solomon, a nationally syndicated media columnist, says the press rarely reported the repression, torture, and lack of human rights in Iran. He says the major media took their cue from U.S. government policy, which saw those problems as secondary to maintaining a stable, pro-Western regime.
This is chronic reliance on official sources, which is not what journalism should be. Authentic journalism should be independent, assertive, inquiry that is not tied to specific official sources. Instead, we had something akin to stenography of the top officials in Washington.
Elaine Schiolino disagrees. She's a senior correspondent with the New York Times, who's covered Iran extensively for over 20 years. She says, given difficult circumstances, many U.S. reporters covered the story well.
Were there journalists who, you know, had special relationships with the Shah and with the U.S. government at the time? Absolutely. Did American diplomats tend to curry favor with the Shah and not report on what was going on in the mosques? Absolutely. But I would argue that, yes, there was a lot of bad journalism before the revolution, but there was also a lot of good journalism.
Professor Farhang says after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and particularly after the seizure of the U.S. Embassy later that year, U.S. media adopted a new set of biases.
Religion and fanaticism come to replace the modernizing frame.
Religion in Iran has always been a passionate, pervasive force. And so, Iran has turned its back on the outside world.
There was no economics, there was no politics, there was no culture, the society was not pluralistic, the social classes having very diverse tendencies, not at all. The dominant tendency and the dominant frame became religion and virtually nothing else.
In 1997, Iranians elected reformist President Mohammad Khatami. Then in 2000, they elected a reformist majority to parliament. But conservatives maintain control in other institutions. The political situation remains complicated, and U.S. policymakers haven't developed a unified policy towards Iran. In this context, says Professor Farhang, the U.S. media are less likely to take their cues from U.S. policymakers.
Overall, I would say the current press coverage is far better than what it was in the past, and the principal reason is that there is a distrust of the official sources, a skepticism of what officials say to the journalists.
This is a country where a national experiment is going on between Islam and democracy. The country has not quite figured out how much of each chemical to put into the beaker to prevent a massive explosion.
New York Times correspondent Elaine Schiolino.
As a journalist, this is very exciting. It's very dangerous. It's very adventurous because every day one sees this experiment playing out in the streets, in the courts, in the parliament, in the presidential palace, in the villages, in the universities.
When U.S. policymakers focused a great deal of attention on Iran through the 1980s, some major media delivered their most biased coverage. Today, with the end of the Cold War and the situation in Iran far more complicated, at least some major media are providing far better information. For the Iran Project, I'm Deepa Fernandez in New York.
Iran has been called the Bermuda Triangle of U.S. foreign policy because four Washington administrations have gotten lost on the issue. How President Bush navigates relations with Iran will depend on a delicate balance in the U.S. and Iran. Correspondent Kristen McHugh begins our report in Washington, D.C.
Doors opening.
As President Bush takes up work, lobbyists and think tank analysts who advise the new administration are busy in offices near DuPont Circle, scanning the skies and oceans for any incoming political missiles that might hit the new administration. Iran is showing up on Washington's sonar screen more often these days. The U.S. broke diplomatic relations in 1979 and has imposed a series of sanctions over the last 20 years, including the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act of 1996. Neither Republican nor Democratic administrations have been able to bring Iran back into the U.S. sphere of influence. What should President Bush do? Well, there's no lack of advice.
Iran is in a very volatile period.
Jim Phillips is a research fellow on Middle Eastern affairs at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
Those that support terrorism against the U.S., against the West, and against their own people still retain considerable power in the security bureaucracies, in the foundations, in the intelligence services.
Most conservative Republicans oppose a thaw in U.S. relations with Iran. They are joined by some Democrats, particularly those who strongly support Israel. Israel supported Iran during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s and even sold weapons to the conservative mullahs. But today, Israel denounces Iran because of its opposition to the Middle East peace process and for its support of Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon. Ken Bricker is press secretary for the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC.
We believe that President Khatami is for real. Unfortunately, he's not in charge over there. The Council of Guardians, which is the conservative mullahs who are opposed to any relations with the U.S., they're the ones who are in charge.
AIPAC backs the Clinton administration criteria for normalizing relations with Iran. The U.S. says Iran must support the Middle East peace process and support for terrorism and stop developing weapons of mass destruction. For their part, Iranian officials criticize the pro-Israel lobby's undue influence on U.S. thinking. They say the U.S. has no right to dictate Iran's foreign policy. And Mohammad Ali Abdahi, first secretary to Iran's president, flatly denies that his country is developing weapons of mass destruction.
Regardless of what America claims or says, independently, we believe that all nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons should be eradicated and eliminated.
That means that Iran is not developing such weapons?
Undoubtedly, that's what it means.
Some in the U.S. argue that economic interests should take precedence in U.S. relations with Iran. For example, Republicans such as Congressman Bob Ney and Senator Arlen Specter want to end U.S. sanctions. They are supported by national trade groups and big oil companies. Mike Stinson, a senior vice president with ConocoOil in Houston, warns that the U.S. will lose out by ignoring Iran's vast business potential.
It would be a sad, sad thing if we stood by and watched European companies who want this desperately or Japanese companies who want this desperately to simply scoot in front of us and do yet another strategic deal with Iran.
Conoco and other oil companies are also worried about U.S.-backed plans to build a pipeline from the oil-rich Caspian Sea to Turkey. Some oil companies would like to see it run through Iran, a route they argue is shorter and more practical. The ideological and economic splits over Iran policy are likely to continue in Washington for many months to come. Ruling circles back in Iran are also split about reestablishing relations with the U.S. Any major Iranian politician who openly advocates restoring diplomatic ties faces the wrath of militant conservatives. These Iranians demonstrating in Tehran may be chanting death to America. But a recent poll by Iran's culture ministry shows 56% of Iranians want to restore normal diplomatic ties with the U.S. It remains to be seen if that popular opinion will translate into a changed policy. Former President Jimmy Carter has a unique perspective on this issue. He broke diplomatic ties with Iran in 1979 and initiated sanctions. He says today the situation has changed and it's time to move on.
I think the United States government should reach out to Iran with an effort to restore full diplomatic relations, full trade relations. Obviously, Iran would have to meet us halfway before definite steps are taken. But we should not wait until Iran takes the first step.
Back in Washington, the new president will have to confront the Iran debate, an issue that has frustrated four previous administrations. In August, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act will expire unless renewed by Congress. By then, President Bush will have to decide whether to stay in the station or jump on board the train for a new Iran policy.
Doors closing. Please stand clear of the doors. Thank you.
For the Iran Project, I'm Kristen McHugh in Washington.
The United States has a long history of cultural influence in Iran. The Islamic Revolution in 1979 wiped out most popular culture, so many Iranian entertainers moved to Los Angeles. Today, their music CDs and videos are smuggled back to Iran. But some Iranians resent what they consider a new attempt to westernize their culture. Correspondent Deborah Baer begins the story in Los Angeles.
Some of the Persian motifs and Persian rhythmic things. What I play, if you find a santur player in Tehran, you will hear this.
UCLA musicologist Manocher Sadeghi began playing the santur, or hammered dulcimer, as a boy in Tehran. He studied with a master of the Persian classical tradition, a music with ancient roots that has evolved through centuries of Islamic and European cultural influence. By the time Sadeghi was a master musician himself in the late 50s, a different sort of music was emerging in Iran.
They composed these new songs in the Western style, pop songs like French, Italian, and then they put Persian words to it. So that's how the pop music came about. It was pretty appealing to the younger people because they were the ones that they were under the influence of the West.
By the 1970s, Persian pop was huge and its reigning diva was Gugush. She fused modern Western rhythms with traditional Persian melodies and poetry. With the vocal talent of Barbara Streisand and the star power of Madonna, Gugush set a new course in music and fashion, even introducing shorter hairstyles and hemlines. Musicologist Sadeghi says the pop scene didn't emerge in a vacuum.
During the Shah, he had ideology of westernization of Iran very rapidly. So it was not only the music, the whole country was going through this change in industry, in culture, in arts, politics.
Iran was also trying to develop its economy. Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi opened the country to Western oil companies, foreign investment, and his critics charged foreign domination. Western culture flowed through the same pipeline, both the good and the bad.
The negative things were like promiscuity, breaking the family ties, pornography, uses of drug, and gradually losing their faith in their religion.
Anger was building over growing Western domination of the economy, U.S. support of the Shah's dictatorship, and an increasingly repressive military. Conservative clerics mobilized anti-Western sentiment into a popular movement that ended the Shah's reign in 1979. In the new Islamic Republic, everything Western was out. Prayers and dirges were in. Pop was banned. The industry virtually shut down. Women couldn't perform in front of men. Gugush stayed in Iran, and her career was frozen in time. But most of Iran's pop singers fled to the West. Many ended up in Los Angeles, already home to a growing Iranian-American community. West L.A. is the heart of what Iranians here call Tehranjalis. Iran's music industry was transplanted and reemerged in the 1980s. L.A. became the new capital of Persian pop. Old stars flourished and new ones emerged.
افتخاری در صحنه موسیقی جهان. Andy.
My name is Andy Andronic Medadian, and my friends call me Andy, which is the same as Andy.
Andy is the Ricky Martin of LA Persian pop. His music videos include lots of Western instruments and sexy female dancers.
I sing about girls, mostly about love, game, love, loves, beautiful girls, mostly beautiful Iranian girls, and dance music.
Andy's musical roots are decidedly Western. In the 1970s in Iran, when everyone was going gaga over Gugush, he was singing rock cover tunes in Tehran clubs catering to Europeans and Americans.
In high school, I got attracted to music because we had Voice of America blasting in radio stations in Iran, and I would listen to all this rock music coming from America, Rod Stewart, Deep Purple, Pink Floyd, Elton John.
In 1978, dreaming of becoming an American rock star, Andy moved to L.A., where he became a Persian-American pop star instead. Andy's big with the under-30 crowd in North America, Europe, and Iran, where pop, though illegal, continued to thrive underground. His smuggled tapes are widely bootlegged from Iran to Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan.
When something is banned, people want more. Because we are banned in Iran, I mean, even people who don't like us, they buy us.
Until a few years ago, Iranians caught with banned pop music faced fines, whippings, even jail. But today, the reformist government of President Mohammad Khatami is more tolerant. At a teen hangout in the foothills above Tehran, kids breakdance to Western music blaring from a boombox. Just about everyone knows Andy's music.
I like him partially because of his personality, and his music's very happy. It's very alive.
Andy is both loved and hated. Some Iranian teens think Andy and other L.A. Persian pop singers are too westernized.
They sing garbage. It doesn't make sense. You can't figure out what they're talking about, so I don't listen to them.
To combat what it sees as the pernicious influence of Western music, the government now allows Iranian musicians to perform indigenous pop. Fans like this teen consider it more compatible with Iranian culture.
The local pop music has meaning behind it. They take lyrics from the classic poets. There is a meaning and context to the song, which the kids relate to. It's also Islamic. It stays within the boundary of our culture. The stuff made over there by Andy, there's no message to it.
While opinions are split on Andy, all of the young people interviewed idolize Gugush. Banned from performing 20 years ago, the pop diva returned to the stage last year. She made a concert tour not in Iran, but in the West, after being granted permission to travel. While abroad, she released a new CD called Zoroaster, featuring the song Captive Land.
It's about a land that has been captive.
Alan Gassami promoted Gugush's sold-out U.S. concerts.
She came from a captive land, but she's hoping, like everybody, that the new government would be more moderate. And it's time. After 20 years, it's time to be moderate. It's time to be a little bit westernized.
Just how moderate or how westernized Iran should be is the subject of ongoing political and cultural debate.
The Persian people, whether they're fanatic or not fanatic, they have a different point of view toward their culture.
UCLA musicologist Manocher Sadeghi.
Whatever it will happen for that country, it will be in the hand of those people there.
Gugush and L.A.'s Persian pop singers dream of performing again in their native land, and they're optimistic it will happen. Until then, they remain artists in exile, and the battle for Iran's soul continues, both in politics and culture.
In the opinion of many scholars, the rush was too fast, sort of modernization and industrialization, and taking away people's religion, and the culture could not take it. Now in the future, the Western influence and Persian influence and the religion and the freedom, it will all take its own place and people will have a better system in the future. New music will be emerging.
For the Iran Project, I'm Deborah Baer in Los Angeles.
Whether the issue is pop music or political dissent, Iran has undergone profound changes since the 1979 revolution. The country has evolved from a repressive, theocratic state to one where reformers and conservatives do daily battle over democratic freedoms. Both sides say Iran must determine its future free from U.S. domination, but they profoundly disagree on how or even whether to build a democratic Islamic state. The changes in Iran open new possibilities for improving U.S.-Iranian relations, but it remains to be seen if leaders on either side will take advantage of those possibilities. The Struggle for Iran was produced by Reese Ehrlich in association with KQED Radio in San Francisco. The show was made possible by the Stanley Foundation, producers of Common Ground, Radio's weekly program on world affairs. For more information about Iran or to post your comments about this program, visit our website at www.iranproject.org. That's www.iranproject.org. We want to thank Maziar Bahari and Babak Peruz for their work in Tehran and Helen Papper for her reporting in Georgia. Thanks to WBEZ in Chicago, and special thanks to sound engineers Kenneth Mason and Katrine Gukoff in Washington, D.C., and Tim Scott Lissy of KWPC in Muscatine, Iowa. You've been listening to the Iran Project's radio special, The Struggle for Iran. I'm your host, Walter Cronkite.